So I want to start with a bit of geography so you know what we're dealing with. In the century before Jeremiah, that is the 8th century, the major power was Assyria. The mountains and then the two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris River. The capital was Nineveh of Assyria, and the religious capital was Ashur, hence the name Assyria. That was the major power, and it was beginning to expand westward. And that happened throughout the 8th century. By the time we come to Jeremiah, Babylon, southern Iraq, today's term, overthrew the power of Assyria, and they're the ones that came to Jerusalem and took them into exile. And that's Jeremiah's a lot about that. Judah, which is our focus of attention, it's not even as big as that, really. It is as big as that, but it's nearly all desert. There's Jerusalem right up on the top corner, and most of the rest is desert country. And so that's Judah. How tiny in this massive world. Surrounding it are Syria, not Assyria. And here you have Moab and Edom and Ammon. Here you've got Egypt. You've got Arabia, which is kind of desert at that stage. Couldn't cross it even with camels. That was all later. So that's the world we're dealing with. And we're looking at a prophet who spoke in Jerusalem, in this tiny little hilltop small city, trying to help them live well. I'll take you back now. There were prophets in the beginning, right from the beginning, before writing, so that we haven't got their words. They're mentioned in the Bible, in different books, by name, and there'd be many of them, and all you'll know is the name, and then you'll forget it, because you don't know anything about them, really. In the last years of writing began in Samaria, it seems. That's when it was rich enough, powerful enough, in that tiny world, to be able to have a library and begin actual writing. And so before that, all you've got is names. King Jeroboam II, I've got the dates there, of the northern part, that's Israel as distinct from Judah, he there's 40 years there, right till the middle of the 700s. And that's when Israel was by far, that's the northern kingdom, far more powerful than Judah. Judah was a backwater. We know, in fact, that there were prophets. We know their name from books of Samuel and Kings mentioned. You'll know three of them. They talk about prophets in the king's court to advise him. They gave him good advice and bad advice. The three you know about, I've got them there. You know about Samuel, the last of the so-called judges, and the first of the prophets. And then you've got Elijah and Elisha, and there are legends about them in the books of Kings. Writings from the 8th century, now we're in the period of writing. So we scribes would have taken down some of the things that these particular prophets spoke, and you'll know them all by name, and you may know more about them than their name. In Israel, that's the northern part here, Samaria, the northern part of that part of the world, you know of Amos, who wrote prior to the middle of the century, writing during the time of Jeroboam II, and most of all, complaining about the Samaria, which was full of wealth, riches, at the expense of the country people. So it's a magnificent prophecy against greed and about caring for the poor and so on. It's almost written today. It's very modern and quite beautiful. He was followed by Hosea in that part, 750 to 724, right up till Samaria was destroyed by the Assyrians. They're spreading west. And of course, Israel isn't strong enough to defend itself against them. At the same time, in Judah, the southern part, of which Jerusalem is the capital, you've got the prophets Isaiah and Micah. And then that period ends with the devastation of Judah by the Assyrians. They didn't actually capture Jerusalem because they didn't care. They could have, but they didn't particularly, weren't interested. But the whole of Judah was devastated, except for the capital city. And that was a problem because from then on, they often thought, oh, Jerusalem can never be destroyed by anybody. The temple of Yahweh is there, so Yahweh will defend it, whatever happens. That kind of mentality grew up because of the fact that it was actually spared. It seems to have been spared because the Assyrians had to go back and quell a revolt back in, which was always happening back in their own home territory. And so they were satisfied with a massive amount of money that they had to kind of get every year to pay to keep some kind of peace and control. Now for three really, really, really important things to look at before we start looking at the prophets, Jeremiah, etc. We need to ask ourselves, what do we mean when we say that a prophet is inspired? I hope that doesn't sound too silly a question. It's actually quite a profound one and not easy to get a clear answer to. But there's a lot of, you'll pick up what you want to out of what I share with you. So that's what I want to look at with you now for 5 or 10 minutes. When we say it's inspired, what does that mean? We're not saying that a God outside, a God in heaven somewhere, wherever heaven is, puts words into the prophet's mind and heart and he speaks them, almost like a dictation. You know that. So it's not that. God outside, of course God is outside. God's in everyone here in this room and you're outside me. But if that's all God was, we've got the wrong God. God is, Teilhard de Chardin says, the heart and the beyond of everything. So instead of thinking of an outside God inspiring, let's say, Jeremiah to speak and to write, or others could do the writing, it must be something to do with prayer. It must be something to do with insight. It must be something to do with truth. And it's not recognized by the prophet themselves. People, as you'll see when you do Jeremiah, anyone can claim to be a prophet. The claim doesn't make him a prophet. It's the other people listening and the other people heeding. And then the story of what happened, the history that went on, that makes people look back even and say, wow, Jeremiah was inspired. He was in touch with the truth. Look, meditate on this yourself. We experience God when we experience our own heart in communion with reality. This is how you experience God and how I experience God. I don't want to say we don't experience it also outside, but if it's all outside, we're not experiencing it. The mind can know about, only the heart can know. And so Jeremiah's heart must have been touched by the mystery of God dwelling in Jeremiah, as well as in Jerusalem and all around him. And it's that experience. A prophet's words are said to be inspired when they're judged to be in touch with reality and to come from an enlightened heart. We're looking for that when we start reading the text of Jeremiah. A third point. The words of a prophet are said to be inspired, and they're treasured by the people who said they're inspired, and they're handed on because they speak to our heart. What the prophet said troubled me, or inspired me, or moved me. And so as we still do with people we call prophets, it's that response that's the key to it. Then they're judged to come from the prophet's heart in communion with God. So God is very much part of inspiration. Of course, God is the one inspiring from without and essentially from within. And now I make a very important point. This is not true of all that the prophet says. At times, the words of a prophet, and we'll see stacks of this in Jeremiah, reveal the limits of the author's insights and the biases that he had and that the community had. Oversights that every culture has them. We've got them. We don't see certain things because of social pressure. We live within this thing, and we're not aware that we're biasing things and seeing them actually in a crooked way. I'll give you some examples. In the prophecies of Jeremiah, there's an assumption that God controls history. Let's hold that for a minute. God is controlling history, in their view. So, if the Babylonian army comes along and destroys Jerusalem, which it does, Jeremiah has to think, and everyone around him assumes, since God is just, God wouldn't do that. God wouldn't get them to do this to our capital city unless we'd done something wrong, and God was doing it to punish us and to wake us up so that we'll behave ourselves. I'm sure you can follow the logic of all that. So that's what they thought. Jesus didn't think that. We shouldn't think it. I don't think you think that God raised up Hitler to teach the Jews a lesson. If you do think it, you may as well leave the retreat now, because I'm not going to help you. God raised up Hitler to get Western Europe. Heavens, there's sin in this world, and we do things that are not inspired by God and don't blame God for them. So the idea that God is in control of history rather than loving and inspiring, and how do we know God is the latter? Because we watch Jesus and we see him weeping over Jerusalem. He didn't go in and clean it up. He wept over. God's weeping over Jerusalem. God's weeping over the Nazi party. God's weeping, and so on. But that's not the way Jeremiah saw it. And no one around him saw it that way. So you're going to find, I'll cut most of them out because I'll do enough to show you. Jeremiah is full of this assumption, which we have to be aware of. And that didn't come from inspiration. That came from Jeremiah's mental attitude, where he misread the inspiration. They thought of God as a warlord. And the Jewish scriptures had a massive influence on the Quran, for example, which was tribal material too. And God in the Quran is a warlord. Absolutely. And so he is in a lot of this literature of the Bible. So we want God to come and slaughter our enemies, and we want God to come and take their children and crash them against the rocks. You'll find that in the Psalm if you care to look. There's a whole lot of pretty horrific stuff in this that you can't say God is inspiring. God hates the enemies of Israel, they thought. And then we read Jesus, who said, "It was said to you of old." We'll read it. but I say to you, something so different. It was said, hate your enemies. I say, no, love your enemies, says Jesus. How different. Jeremiah would have thought he was gone off that planet, missed the whole thing. Surely they would have locked Jesus up, they would have crucified Jesus, because he can't be right. And when he tells to love your enemies, the reason Jesus gives is the point I'm making, I hope, because he said that's what your Father does. Your Father lets the rain come on the just and the unjust, and the sun to warm the righteous and the unrighteous. God is love. God doesn't hate anybody. Well, that would have been a shock to Jeremiah and his compatriots. I hope I've made the point clearly, because God has to inspire real people with our real oversights and our real lack of awarenesses. But people can have oversights and lack of awareness and still say some beautiful things from God. And that's what we're looking for. It's like looking for flowers in a forest when there's been a drought or something. The flowers are there, but not all of it is beautiful. That's my first point. And I guess that takes a lot of absorbing and thinking, and I've just used my best words. I'm not sure how good they are, but I hope the point's as clear as I can make it. A second important point, because when we use the word prophet, if we're not thinking, and we often aren't, we think it's somebody foretelling the future. Well, it isn't that. Of course, in the prophets, I'll put what I've got here, generations of scholars were responsible for the evolving sources that the final authors drew on. And there were those who cherished these ancient scrolls, copied them, and made sure they were handed on. And that whole process is providentially inspired. Inspiration has to cover the whole process of reflecting, listening, discussion, and prayer. And because God was thought of as a living God, who is not dead, for God's sake, God is inspiring all the time, still. God is a living God. So when the scholars found what Jeremiah had said, written down by him, perhaps by his disciples, more than likely, whether he wrote or not is another issue, but the writing's done. When they got their scrolls, this is so important, and I had to learn this, so maybe you have to learn it too. They didn't do what we would do. Keep the text sacredly fixed, don't interfere with it, and use footnotes or commentaries to try and update it. No, they took the word and updated the word. It's constantly growing. It's constantly not losing its essence, but people, scribes, 2 centuries later, 3 centuries later, in Jeremiah's case, 4 and 5 centuries later, are looking at it and seeing in the text meanings that they can now discern there. So they put them there. Because this has to be read in the synagogue and so on. It's a living document. Unfortunately, there came a time when it got fixed. This was before Christianity started. It was a fixed text. And the problem with fixed texts is we start to adore them. We start to think they've got final truth. And whereas they didn't think that way at all. They kept, I think I've made that point. In his History of Prophecy in Israel, Joseph Blenkinsop, I will quote some people, he's an amazingly good writer because he writes English. A lot of scholars don't, and that's all right. They're writing to each other, and I don't mean that critically. They're writing in a way like a mechanic writing to a mechanic about a car engine. I wouldn't be able to read it, and it wouldn't make any sense to you behind the wheel. But they know what they're talking about in this technical term. Same here. Scholars can, but Blenkinsop is one of the, I'll say few, I think, one of the few that when he writes, it actually connects and it makes sense and carries you with it. So if you see the name, by all means, get it. He states that the prophetic books of the Old Testament reveal, and this is a quote, a cumulative process of appropriation, making it our own, assimilation, and adaptation that shades off into an increasingly, I'm going blind, frequent recycling and reinterpreting of older prophetic material. I think he says it perfectly. And by, all scholars say it, it's not just one opinion. Hence, the difficulty sometimes of knowing whether a text comes from the prophet or from the reflections of later scribes. And we often, scholars are working at that all the time, we're often a bit uncertain. There are piles of stuff in Jeremiah's prophets which I'm not actually going to do with you. When God is having a go at the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Edomites and the Egyptians and the Babylonians and that kind of stuff, and I think the best scholars tell us that's later stuff. That's coming from centuries afterwards. Jeremiah was certainly talking about God speaking to Judah. Did he ever talk about the other nations? Unlikely. But it's in the prophecy, because later scribes in a different situation saw how important it was to realize that God wasn't just punishing us. God is punishing all the peoples for their sin. We actually know that God's not punishing anybody. God is trying to love people out of sin, not punish them into it, or because they're in it. And I've talked about that accumulation, growth of a text, life. It's a living text. It's a living word. And at one stage, sadly, that kind of was stopped. So from then on, it has to come just as commentary. The New Testament, for example, re-looks at all the prophets in the light of Jesus, but they didn't interfere with the prophetic text. They remain intact. They just kind of gave them a different slant. My third point is that prophecy is a critique of the present moment. And of course it is. A prophet was speaking to real people in real situations about what was really happening to them. Sometimes they do talk about the future in this sense, that they say, look, if you don't behave like this, this is what's going to happen to your kids and your grandkids. I don't go further than that. But, you know, if you don't shape up, look what's going to happen. Well, of course they did that. But they didn't talk about the future as though they're looking into a crystal ball. And whenever the prophets speak about the future in a timeless way, and they do that, they're never talking about us. They're always talking about God. If you listen, God will always be there. If you don't listen, God will always be there. So God transcends all history. But the prophet didn't, and the people listened to him didn't either. It's about real people. The Old Testament prophecy is the critique which the prophets make of their contemporary society in God's name. Personal encounter with Yahweh shaped their awareness of the contrast between social behavior and the authentic Yahwist religious insights that they'd inherited from Moses and all through the history. This task was to, quoting Amos, was to declare to Jacob his transgressions and to Israel his sin, to show us where we're going wrong. It's part of what a prophet is called to do. Insisting that sin must be punished. And so they called for repentance so that God would stop punishing us, as they thought of it. But also insisting, and this is the beautiful part that we notice if we read the text carefully, also insisting there was something that transcended punishment and sin and repentance, namely Yahweh, that's the Lord God, fidelity to who Yahweh is. Yahweh will always keep Yahweh's promises. So we get glimpses, and sometimes very beautiful glimpses, of a God who, though they thought God was controlling their history, they thought that wrongly. What they thought rightly was that God is faithful to the covenant and faithful to love. Diane Bergent, an American scholar, writes, "The prophetic word was always relevant to the historical moment of its proclamation. Since it was born out of religious and political crisis, its purpose was to speak to that crisis. It clung to the past to the extent that it was in continuity with the fundamental religious tradition. It predicted the future, and this is very good, and watch it carefully, to the extent that the future would be the consequences of the present. The primary intent of prophecy was to call the people to fidelity to their religious responsibilities here and now." It's for this reason that it's important to read the prophetic literature in the light of the specific historical circumstances to which the words were addressed, or in which the writings were recorded. And that's exactly what I'll be doing. I've already shown the geography. I want you to look at the history, because in the real situation they're in, that's what Jeremiah's addressing. We need to know it to be able to read them properly. The power of the prophetic utterance comes precisely from its specific nature. And if we take it out of context and say it's the word of God and then preach it to people, if somebody gets up because there's a drought in Australia in a pulpit somewhere, God, I hope we don't go this crazy, but we might, some might, and starts to say God's punishing us because we voted yes, as I voted, for the gay marriage thing. So I'm getting punished because I didn't say no. Do you know what I mean? That can happen. Once this is grasped, it's up to us, following the example of the disciples of the prophets, to apply what they say to our changed circumstances. What Jeremiah said to his situation, does that have something to say to mine? It may not, but it probably does. And that's what we're looking for, that connection. To apply what they said to our changed circumstances, not by a literal application of their words, but by a faithful following of their inspired insights. One last point of introduction on this. How do you discern true from false prophecy? Jeremiah's scroll is dealing with that all the time, because it's very difficult. Nearly all the, inverted commas, prophets at the time were saying what I half said earlier, Jerusalem will be fine, it's God's city, no matter what we do, we'll survive. So eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow, etc. It's going to be fine. Jeremiah alone was saying against all this. This pleased the kings and pleased the princes and pleased the rich, that kind of chatter from the prophets, people who claimed to be prophets and were acknowledged as prophets by the people who wanted to hear what they wanted to hear. Jeremiah is a lonely prophet because he's kept saying this is a whole lot of rubbish you're being told. Look at your lives, look at what's going on. If you continue to do this, the city is going to be destroyed. And they dumped him in a pit, they tried to kill him and get rid of him. And then, of course, when the city was destroyed, people had to rethink what they'd been doing, because he proved to be the one who was in touch with God, was in touch with his own heart, and was in touch with the political situation that he was addressing. How do we discern true from false prophecy, and that's something that's still with us today, of course. We're always trying to do this. Well, these are some of the things that emerge in, particularly in Jeremiah, who addresses this more than anybody. Moses is presented as the exemplar of all true prophets. So if someone says something that contradicts Moses and the Torah, it's wrong. But I hope you can see a problem here. If that's what they saw, then you come to Jesus, and he's not fasting on a fast day, and he's eating with sinners, and the books say don't do that. And if he's, you know, I could go on and on and on, I don't need to. The scholars, the people who knew the Bible really well, were one of the groups responsible for having Jesus crucified. So it was said to you of old, but I say to you, we needed someone as beautiful and pure and clear as Jesus, who, finish that sentence, another retreat, but who was who he is. We needed something like that to free us from reading the prophets as though they were the last word. But that's one of the criteria they had, and on the whole, it's a good one. Secondly, to be accepted as authentic prophecy, oracles had to be uttered in the name of Yahweh, the God who spoke to Moses in the burning bush, their traditional understanding of God, not in the name of some foreign god, Molech or whoever. And they had to be consistent with the inspired words and deeds of Moses. They had to be consistent with approved prophecy. It was one of the other criteria they tried to reach for. So if you've got Amos speaking like this, and Hosea speaking like this, and Habakkuk speaking like this, somehow or other, if there's someone out here with a totally different message, they're inclined not to listen, because that would mean they were all wrong and he's right, etc. Here's Jeremiah saying, prophet, no less than priest, all practice fraud. They dress my people's wound without concern. Peace, peace, they say. This is Jeremiah's words, but there's no peace. Again, Jeremiah. Don't listen to what the prophets say. They're deluding you. They retail visions of their own, not what comes from the mouth of Yahweh. They're not listening to God. They're not listening to God in their own heart. They're official prophets saying what will please the king or someone equivalent. Jeremiah again, speaking for God. I haven't sent them, but they're running. I haven't spoken to them, yet they're prophesying. We can all be guilty of this. Jeremiah again. Let the prophet who has a dream tell the dream as his own. Let him who receives a word from me, from God, deliver it accurately. Doesn't my word burn like a fire? Is it not like a hammer shattering the rock? It's a beautiful image. And the rabbis in the early period of Christianity too, they loved quoting this text. And they were looking, unlike modern scholars on the whole, modern scholars are aiming to get to the meaning of the text. What did the author actually mean? How was it understood? And this is a wonderful study, of course. How was it understood at the time? What's actually saying? That's all we're looking for. They weren't looking for that. They wanted to take the word, any word, word of prophecy of anybody, and hit it with a mallet or something, and then all the sparks that fly out of the rock. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for 100 meanings. The more meanings you can see in a text, the better, as they saw. So they were constantly looking at it, turning it, taking different angles on it to discover what, because it's God's word, what possible meanings could be there. And that's why when they saw other meanings, they shaped the text to say it. Here's Jeremiah again. I never sent them or commissioned them. They serve no good purpose for the people. Here's Ezekiel. The message is pretty clear already, but now that I'm on a high horse, I'll continue it, okay? Say to those who make up prophecies out of their own heads, say this, the Lord Yahweh says, woe to the foolish prophets who follow their own spirit without seeing anything. They're like jackals in a ruin. So are my prophets, Israel, so your prophets. They've never ventured into the breach. They've never bothered to fortify the house of Israel to stand fast in battle. They've never been there and tried to do something about their kind of prophesying from a pulpit somewhere or an ivory tower. They have empty visions and they give lying prophecies and they say it's Yahweh who speaks, although Yahweh hasn't sent them. Instead of my people rebuilding the wall, these men come and slap on plaster. The prophets on the whole are poets. It's pretty good language, isn't it? So there's a great crack on the wall, so they cover it up with a bit of plaster while the building is ready to collapse. Later generations attempted to understand themselves in the light of preserved and treasured prophecy. They saw the prophetic oracles in a new light from their own circumstances. They understood particular historical events as revelations of the transcendent hope or of the warnings of the prophet. They expected that God's will would be beyond their ability to comprehend fully, and so they approached the inspired word expecting that they'd find many hidden meanings there to be discovered. They liked to break it open and to use the sparks of light that issued from it, revealing the divine enlightenment hidden within. The texts expressed inspired insights into the presence and action of a loving God, a faithful God, in their history. No text could hold it all, and so the history of the development of the Old Testament, all over Torah, prophets, writings, is a history of prayerful debate, discussion, and refinement, always in the light of historical experience. So we come to the last years of the 8th century at the time of Hezekiah, 727 to 715. Thank you, that is actually better. Didn't think of that. Let there be light. Thank you, Pauline. But it's my glasses and my eyes that are the problem, but thank you. There you've got... Oh, can you read that with the light on? Oh. I don't know, you can read it, can you?
I can read it on the back.
It's hard, yeah.
I forgot about you. I might turn this one up.
I'll try it on the other side.
I'll try this one up.
Oh, that's better.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, this one's fine. I mean, yeah. So we're coming to the time of the four prophets that I mentioned from the 8th century. In 721, that was the northern Israel was destroyed by the Assyrians. And it never came back again till after the Second World War or whatever this last century. So that was lost, finished. And what happened was, there's Samaria, there's Jerusalem. The refugees flooded south into Judah, which, as I said, is mainly sand and rock. There's Jerusalem right up there at the northern part of it. So this is where our focus from now on is going to be. It was during the reign of Hezekiah in Judah, that's still in the 8th century, but before he was old enough to rule in his own right, which was 715, that the Assyrian army captured Samaria, refugees from the northern kingdom, it called Israel, poured into Jerusalem, which had to expand to the western hill, and the city's population, so the experts say with confidence, the city's population may have increased as much as 15 times from about 1,000. So in the 8th century BC, Jerusalem was 1,000 people. God, every suburb around here is probably Douglas Park, so I don't know if Douglas Park has 1,000, but it could. And it's tiny. Well, it went from 1,000 to 15,000 inhabitants because of the migration, the refugees, and they didn't have a border protection policy. They actually welcomed their brothers and sisters because they were poor and in need. What a lovely idea. Why have we forgotten that? Anyhow, so they did. And, of course, the ones from the north, coming from Samaria, brought down their scrolls. The scrolls of Amos and Hosea, and probably the beginnings of stories about Jacob from the north, and little sacred sites where a particular group, tribal group, would come and they'd tell their story. So there's bits of that. We don't know what yet. We can't be determined about. There's stuff coming down, and Jerusalem now learns the trade and starts to write it itself. The population of Judah, which had long hovered at a few tens of thousands, now grew to about 120,000. And you find all that in that book that I recommend. It was during the reign of King Hezekiah that the Assyrian army put down a revolt by the Philistine city-state of Ashdod, near Gaza. Sennacherib succeeded Sargon II in 705. There's no exam at the end, you don't have to remember this, but just get a feel for it. The death of Sargon led to revolts in every section of the Assyrian Empire. Hezekiah seems to have played a significant role in the organizing the rebellion in Palestine. The prophet Isaiah, Ben Amos, was active in attempting to deter him from the policy which he saw as a failure to trust in Yahweh. Hezekiah went ahead, and as I said a lot earlier, Judah was destroyed in 701, but Jerusalem survived. Though Judah was devastated in 701, Jerusalem itself survived intact. The tribute demanded by Assyria was to weigh heavily on Judah for the first 70 years of the 7th century, the period just prior to Jeremiah. The farmers had to give, I don't know what the percentage was, but an enormous amount. It was a very difficult time for Judah to keep surviving this heavy tribute. Now, there are no writings in the period of relative stability when Judah was a vassal kingdom of the Assyrian Empire during the reign of Manasseh, which was a long reign, as you can see by the dates there, and his son Amon, who was only reigned for 2 years. Hezekiah's son Manasseh came to the throne as a boy of 12, just at the turn of the century, in 698. And he reigned till 643, a long reign. He had no choice but to submit to being a vassal of the Assyrian king. There would have been those in Judah, probably, including priests from the smaller sanctuaries, who blamed Hezekiah for the way things turned out, and many welcomed Manasseh's long reign. Things fell apart religiously, and that's mentioned in the book of Kings, but because the king was a loyal vassal of the powerful Assyrian king, there was peace in Judah and growing economic prosperity. In 641, we're getting close now, Manasseh's son Amon was assassinated, and his 8-year-old son Josiah inherited the throne of Judah. Josiah's 12th year as king was the year of the death of Ashurbanipal, the king of Assyria. And Josiah, so the big Assyrian empire is in a state of collapse. So Josiah, now he's about 18, he's old enough to take the reins himself, he took the occasion to throw off the vassalage that had kept Judah subject to Assyria for a century. He was able to because of changed political situation. He was determined to win back for Judah the northern kingdom and the land that tradition said was promised Israel by Yahweh. The Exodus saga and the Deuteronomic history reflect the ideology of King Josiah, because now they could come out from underground, because they were, religion was pushed underground. They could now come out. They found Josiah to be the perfect Messiah, king that they were longing for. And so the Deuteronomist, then the book of Deuteronomy, is now beginning to emerge as the spirit of the Torah. The population of Judah probably did not exceed 75,000, down from the 120,000 before the devastation of 701. So in that 20 years, the place was devastated, so the population had gone right down again. With relative dense occupation of the rural areas in the Judean hill country, a network of settlements in the arid zones to the east and south, and a relatively sparse population in the Shephelah, that is the mountain slopes going down to the Mediterranean. It was in many ways a densely settled city-state, as the capital held about 20% of the population. Urban life in Jerusalem reached a peak that would be equaled only in Roman times. The state was well organized and highly centralized, as in the time of Manasseh. But in terms of its religious development and literary expression of national identity, the era of Josiah marked a dramatic new stage in Judah's history. Jeremiah begins his prophecy during the reign of Josiah. So this is too much to take in, I know, but if you get some feel, this is important background to what we're going to read. Josiah insisted that all cult had to take place in Jerusalem temple and nowhere else. This centralizing of the cult was the single most influential change brought about by Josiah's reform. It's backed up again and again in the book of Deuteronomy and accounts for many changes that dramatically affected the way worship was carried on in Judah. Things would never be the same again. They couldn't have any little sanctuaries anywhere else. It all had to be in the temple in Jerusalem. Josiah cleared Judah of cult sites. He expanded the borders in every direction. This was possible because Egypt was still not strong and Assyria was fighting a losing battle with Babylon and with the Medes, Iran. The Torah and the Deuteronomistic history were composed, the beginnings of it, in Jerusalem. The writing was to continue in exile. The state of Judah was sufficiently complex and organized for such a project only with the influx of refugees from Israel after 720 BC. Some written material was brought down from Samaria, which was founded by King Omri and which experienced unprecedented prosperity back under Jeroboam II. The patriarchal narrative, the Deuteronomistic history, express the religious convictions and political ambitions of Judah under King Josiah. It's a most important period of understanding the development of the Old Testament scriptures. And now we come to where I want to take you. The prophetic oracles in Judah at the end of the 7th century into the beginning of the 6th. King Josiah was the king, and during that time you have the prophet Zephaniah and the prophet Nahum and some of the prophet of Jeremiah. When he was killed in Megiddo by the Egyptian pharaoh, because he tried to intervene, the reign went to King Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. And during that time we have the prophecy of Habakkuk and also Jeremiah. At his death during the siege of Jerusalem in 598, his son Jehoiakim, sometimes called Jeconiah or Coniah, the different names, he took over, but he only lasted 3 months, and then Jerusalem was captured and he was taken into exile. When he was taken into exile, they put one of his uncles, took the name, the throne name Zedekiah, who reigned there for 10 years, and he tried to revolt against Babylon, and that led the Babylonian army to come and destroy the city, flatten the temple, and cart off anyone who was anybody, and that's the exile. So the prophet Jeremiah lasts through those years. Here's chapter 1, verse 1 to 2. The words of Jeremiah, son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anathoth, in the land of Benjamin. Obviously some scribes have started the writings off in that way. King Josiah began his reign in 640. At the death of Ashurbanipal in 628, that's the 13th year, 627, that's when Jeremiah starts. And then there's the reform in 622, and then the king is killed, as I mentioned, by the Egyptian pharaoh. Abiathar, we're told, was the last chief priest of Eli's family, and he was exiled to an estate in Anathoth, where Jeremiah comes from, for having supported the rival of Solomon. And the text goes on, the texts are always in red. So, to whom the word of Yahweh came in the days of King Josiah, son of Amon of Judah, in the 13th year, and that's 627. Verse 3 reads, and I'm finishing with this and then a little bit of music. The word of God came to Jeremiah also in the days of King Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah of Judah. And there's some of the dates I've already done with you there. And until the end of the 11th year of King Zedekiah. That's the year of the destruction of the city. Captured in 598, destroyed 10 years later by the Babylonians. Until the end of the 11th year of King Zedekiah, son of Josiah of Judah, until the captivity of Jerusalem in the fifth month. So, a lot to give you when you first arrive, but at the time of Josiah, when there's reform happening and a bit of excitement about freedom, because Assyria is no longer in a position to dominate and Egypt is still comparatively weak, that's how it all starts. Then the Babylonians get more power, and the Babylonians are now threatening Jerusalem, and so you've got Jeremiah trying to handle all that. And then when the king is taken into exile, his uncle is put there as a stooge, puppet king by the Babylonians. He too thinks he can get away with revolting and not paying the tax, and then the Babylonians come in and utterly destroy the city. That's the background for the prophecy of Jeremiah. Tomorrow morning, I'll have two periods with you, if you all come back, or if some of you come back. Now, the first talk is going to be the prophecy of Zephaniah, because we're listening, and some of it's quite beautiful, we're listening to a prophet who's concurrent with Jeremiah. So if he's saying certain things, Jeremiah's living through the same situation. And then in the second talk, I'm going to present the Habakkuk. Again, a wonderful short prophet, short amount of material, because he too is a contemporary of Jeremiah. And that's Saturday, not Sunday, we're going to begin the text of Jeremiah.